So last week we began RIPE, and we began with Isaiah, and we saw that we're introduced to this idea that the Christian life is a life on mission. The ultimate goal in life is not mission, it's actually worship as a Christian. To find Jesus as the most satisfying experience, relationship on the planet. That he is living water and he is bread of life. But what comes out of the overflow of that is mission. Doing anything we can in God's providence to help others experience what we have first found. Now, by missional living, and I'll say this probably every single Sunday and Wednesday, I am not saying that being a Christian means that today you must walk out, hire a realtor, sell your home, sell all your possessions, move overseas to a people group that has not heard the name of Jesus yet, and to give the rest of your life to foreign missions. I am saying that to be a Christian fundamentally means that you have a purpose for life that runs much deeper and is much more meaningful than what America teaches you about what life is about. It is a life that seeks the kingdom of Jesus over all earthly kingdoms, whether it is Tampa, Hillsborough County, Florida, Washington, our country, or any other kingdom on this planet, or your own very physical address and your own personal kingdom. It is a life that knows that the best way to build your kingdom, if that's what you really want to do, the best way to build your kingdom in a way that is going to last forever is not just to focus on blueprints and plans and wood and cement and nails and screws and appliances and income, but it's to make Jesus and his kingdom your ultimate priority. And I believe that this is definitive, the missing link at Heritage for Heritage Christians. This is, yes, the final task that I believe that God has put in my heart in the continuation of my preaching ministry and pastoring ministry here at Heritage. That Heritage Christians will see Jesus and his kingdom, like Jesus says, that it's a treasure that is hidden in a field that a man would stumble upon and give up everything in his life in order to acquire that field. So last week we began with Isaiah chapter 6, and you heard the very special place that Isaiah chapter 6 holds in my heart. So now you know about Romans 8, and now you know about Isaiah chapter 6. You were meant to see that missional living actually begins with God's heart. It doesn't begin with the needs of people. It doesn't begin with yourself. It begins with who God is, his character, his great heart for people created in his image. So we saw that God is king and God is holy, yet at the same time, he's also equally powerfully forgiving and gracious. Two things that we normally don't put together with kings and sovereigns. God worked a heart of mission into Isaiah at the precise time where Isaiah was grieving and he was suffering through the death of a loved one, the king that he worked closely with. And across my 9 years of pastoral ministry here at Heritage, I have discovered that grief and sorrow, the very things that Isaiah faced, are two major reasons why people give up on Jesus and people give up on church and the Bible. And the ironic thing is that grief and sorrow, ironically, are two reasons why Jesus will never give up on you. Why Jesus took the cross, and why Jesus gives to you for your griefs and for your sorrows, his church, your brothers and sisters in Christ. Today we're going to learn that missional living isn't exclusive to a Sunday morning consumeristic experience. You come, you get filled up, and you just go out, and you don't think about it ever again. Missional living is actually public, and it's an everyday way of living, which does clash with American culture, which we'll get to. Let's get to our proposition first. What you're going to see this morning is that from this portion of the Sermon on the Mount, that Jesus is teaching this about missional living. That missional living, it values God's call to live well among people so that those people can get a glimpse of what God is like. As Christians, We are in between the first and the second advent of Jesus. I mean, I hope we're on the tail end of second advent, but I don't know. I don't know. Unlike the shepherds, we cannot go to Bethlehem and see the baby Jesus. Unlike Peter and the disciples, I can't imagine this. We can't share a campfire with Jesus. Like, just like make some s'mores over a fire and ask him questions about life. Jesus is not physically here on earth to show us what his Father is like. However, Jesus left to us his church to be a tangible and a physical expression of what God is like. And I got to be honest, I have to admit, by and large, over the last, I would say maybe 1700 or 1800 years, the church has done a terrible job of this. I believe that the church, especially here in America, deserves every single bit of criticism that non-Christians lavish upon the American church. Yet here at Heritage, we are striving day by day to be different, week by week, gathering after gathering. We want to be all that Jesus wants his church to be and its Christians to be here in America. We don't want to just do church where we give you some program, some experience, you consume and you move on. We want it to be community with a mission for each other and for the world. Being a Christian means that Jesus is our highest value, that he is the highest experience, that he is actually the most meaningful relationship that a human being could ever have. It doesn't mean that marriage or family or friends or work or money or fun or hobbies isn't important or that it doesn't have its place in our lives. Being a Christian means, therefore, that missional living is a high value. I'm not here to tell you that missional living is the highest value. I believe that worship is. Experiencing and enjoying all that God is for you in Jesus as living water and daily bread. But being a church means that missional living has to also be a high reason for why we gather. We gather for a reason, and then we scatter to our different corners of this county or the next county for a reason as well. It means that we must be honest with members of our church and attenders of our church, that being a Christian, especially being a Christian here at Heritage, means a commitment somewhere in your life to missional living. Being a Christian, therefore, is more than just believing that Jesus is real. Demons believe that. Muslims believe that. Jews believe that Jesus is real. It's more than just that. It's more than attending church once a week and getting to know Christians and inviting them into your life. So I pray that after 6 weeks of preaching and teaching, Sundays and Wednesdays through this, that God will create in your heart a desire for missional living. Now, right now, missional living is completely absent from this church's constitution and bylaws. You can look through it and not see a single reference to missional living. Next year, I pray, when we gather together as a church family for an upcoming members' meeting, that we will adopt and we will embrace an amendment, an addition to our constitution and to our affirmations to make it precisely clear that to be a Christian means that we are committed to missional living. Missional living is the tangible result. It is the overflow of loving God with all the heart. So what I'm saying is, the Great Commission that Jesus gives to all Christians in Matthew 28 is actually the overflow of when you're truly observing the Great Commandment. One way to know, am I loving God with all of my heart, mind, soul, and strength, is if you are going into the lives of people and discipling them. That's the truest gauge. The Great Commission is a pointer of whether the Great Commandment is taking place. Today, we're going to see the way that Jesus calls Christians who meaningfully belong in a local church, how they're supposed to look like, how they're supposed to love, how they're supposed to live for him with all of their hearts. Jesus calls this in the Sermon on the Mount, salt and light living. And we'll see what Jesus means by these two metaphors and how Jesus wants you as a Christian today in America to live publicly in front of non-Christians in such a way that it draws attention not to yourself, but to Jesus as the ultimate treasure in life. And then we're going to consider for us today what's getting in the way. What is our obstacle to salt and light living? That's today in a nutshell. Let's get started. Our first point, you are going to see that Christians publicly live for Jesus in such a way that people can experience God personally. That's what we're going to consider here. Now, in American culture, we are taught that religion is a private matter, right? There are certain things you don't talk about publicly. You don't talk about religion, and you don't talk about politics, right? And what American culture says is, it doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you believe in something, and as long as you aren't hurting anyone. But as Christians, we fundamentally, clearly, and directly disagree with this. Respectfully, we disagree with this. There is no such thing as a person who has the ability to believe something about life, anything. Let's throw Christianity out for a moment. There's no such thing as a person who believes something and it doesn't shape the way they interact with people publicly. This is actually an example of American culture's, ironically, being intolerant of Christianity, which is what they say Christians do to people. Christianity is deeply personal, but it has never been, and it never will be, a private matter. It can't be. This is contradictory to the New Testament's teaching about Christianity. What we're going to see today, that you are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world. Christians are meant to live authentic, not perfect, but authentic, consistent, public lives in front of non-Christians so they can see what is different about Jesus than any other way this planet says you can find for a meaningful life. Christians are different from non-Christians because we say that the most valuable way to live and the most valuable relationship you can have is with Jesus of Nazareth. Now, here's something basic about humanity. Every single person, the religious, the irreligious, the Democrat, the Republican, right? The gay, the straight, the Baptist, throughout some other denomination. Every single person is made in the image of God from conception to death. If you think about when, I know it's not Advent yet, and maybe I'll say it again, but we do have to say it before you do your election ballots. Do you remember, and I'm ad-libbing right now, forgive me. Do you remember when the angel Gabriel told Mary, the Holy Spirit's going to overshadow you, finally all the promises are true, it's going to be you. The first thing she does when Gabriel leaves, she goes to see her relative Elizabeth. She is only maybe some days, some weeks pregnant. But the baby leaps in the womb for Jesus. Because the image of God is deeply birthed at conception. Not days, not weeks, not months, or after delivery. I hope it's okay that I can say that. We can talk more about that Wednesday. We are uniquely human and uniquely a mom and a dad, a son, a daughter, a soul at conception. And because we are created in God's image from conception, every single person has dignity and value and worth, even those on a different political spectrum than you or who believes things differently ethically than you. Because of this, we have what we call in America inalienable rights endowed to us by God as our creator and as our ultimate king. As God's image bearers, therefore, we cannot help but talk about what we treasure. Right? That's how we are made. We cannot help but talk about the things that we find important and find valuable. For some, it's a baseball game, right? For some of you, it's killing an animal, right? For some of us, it's food. We have a great food culture here at Heritage. But you take the shyest, most introverted person you know, and they will come alive, and they will talk endlessly, given the right circumstance and given the right topic. We cannot help but share with others what we find deeply satisfying to us, because it is proof that we are made in the image of God. We talk so much because God is a God who talks. He spoke and created all things. So it is intolerant, actually, ironically intolerant of American culture to attempt to force a Christian or a church to deny one of the most fundamental things about being human. Jesus is the ultimate treasure of every single genuine Christian. Our relationship to Jesus is deeply personal, yes, but it's never meant to be a private matter. Even more, the Christian is different from the non-Christian, not only because we have a different treasure, but we have a different ultimate authority. Christians are called, yes, to submit to authority, even secular, non-Christian authority. I mean, this even goes back to the Jews when Babylon sacked them and they go into exile. The prophets tell them, like, go into those cities and live. Obey the king. Do well. Build homes. Get married. Live life in that culture. God's people are always called to find ways that we can agree, we can affirm, we can live within culture. But when a non-Christian authority or a non-Christian law attempts to force a Christian to go against their conscience and to go against God's clear expressed word, because God is our final authority above legislation and courts and mayors and governors and presidents, a Christian must respectfully say no. Christians believe that Jesus is the highest authority because at his word he created the heavens and the earth. Christians believe that Jesus establishes authority, even authority that you and I may not personally like. This should make us hopeful in this life, that God is the authority above all human authority, and one day, at his second advent, he will hold all authority accountable in the church and outside the church. That is our hope. So in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus teaches us two ways that he wants you as a Christian to publicly live for him. We cannot keep our relationship to Jesus private. We can't. There are public aspects to being a Christian, because missional living is living as salt and living as light. So let's unpack these two metaphors really quick. Verse 13, Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth, and that's what we're going to focus on. But if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? Let's stop there. Jesus compares Christians to salt. You are the salt of the earth. And we got to ask, what do Christians have to do with salt? That's why it's a metaphor. It puts together two things that don't really go together. It's not peanut butter jelly at first glance, but it is peanut butter and jelly. Salt has predominantly been used across human history for three things, but I want to focus on two things. Salt enhances the taste of food. Can I get an amen? All right? Salt has the ability to take what is naturally there and make it better. And when it's salted butter, oh, it's even better, right? Christians are the salt of the world. Salt was also used in the ancient world as a preservative, right? Before the age of refrigeration, before the Industrial Revolution, how do you keep that meat from the animal that you slayed? How do you make that meat last longer? You coat it in salt, right? It delays the decay of the meat. If that meat is not eaten, it is going to ruin. And Jesus says, you, in this way, are the salt world. This world is on its way to ruin, and therefore Christians must be all over it. Christians are the saltiness of the world, the flavor of the world, the preservative of the world. And for much, not all, but much of Christian history, Christians have led the way in the secular world. Education is where it is today. Our public school education system is founded on Christian history. It is. The first universities were not created by secularists. They were created by Christians. Medicine is where it is today because of Christians. The first hospitals in human history were created by Christians. For example, the Roman Empire did not care for the poor. They did not care for the sick. And they did not care for the elderly. When plagues would come across the Roman Empire, they discarded the marginalized, the poor, the weak, the sick, the old. It was the Christians, when Roman officials would leave a town because of a plague, the Christians went into it to care for the sick, to be there for the poor. That is why Christianity exploded in the first couple hundred years, because Christians did not act like Romans, even though some of them were formerly Roman. Christians also pioneered writing and music and the arts. However, today, non-Christians do not look at Christians or the church as leaders in education or medicine or the arts. It's the other way around. The church takes its cues from culture, when historically, for most of human history, culture used to take its cues from the church. Many churches in America have programs that look like more summer camp clubs, events that just seek to compel crowds, music that sounds like the top 25, whatever's going on the radio right now, which I couldn't name probably a single one right now. And we have to ask, is that what Jesus meant when he tells Christians that they're the salt of the earth? And we would respectfully say no. This is not what Jesus means, America. We're sorry. That's Christianity taking its cues from culture instead of the other way around. Non-Christians are meant to see you, the life of a genuine Christian and the life of a genuine church, and then to look at their own life and see, is there a difference? Is there something missing in my life that these people have? And if so, what is it? Why is it that they continue and they endure when they get the worst news from their doctor? When other people turn to addiction? Why is that? Therefore, Christians should be, I believe, in all public spheres of life. I don't think every Christian should go to seminary and be a pastor. No. This is the beauty of the Reformation, which we're coming up on this week and celebrating. Christians should be in all public spheres of life: the arts, medicine, education, government, blue collar, white collar, living authentically as Christians in front of non-Christians so they can have a clear picture of what Jesus is like. Non-Christians are meant to see our lives and discover that there is something different out there that's more satisfying and more enjoyable and more meaningful than what they're currently living. As we do this, we are the salt of the earth. There must be something distinctively different, like salted butter and unsalted butter, right? There is a difference. Christians are the salt of the earth. Now, second metaphor. Verses 14 and 15, Jesus says that you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, and that no one lights a lamp and then puts it under a basket. They put it on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Now Jesus calls Christians light of the world, a city set on a hill, and a lamp. What does a Christian have to do with all three of those images? All three images actually conveys the public nature of the Christian's life. It's meant for other people to see that city on the hill, to know where to go in the dead of night. From reading the Gospel of John, which we have in our church's tenure so far together, we learn that one of the central claims of the Gospel of John that Jesus made about himself is that he is light of the world. So we got to ask Jesus, what is it? Are you the light of the world? Or are we the light of the world? The answer is it's both. Now hear me out. The light of the Christian is dependent and what we say derivative. I know that's a math term, and I'm not a math guy either. Jesus' light is absolute and independent. Christians are like the moon, to my understanding. The moon has no inherent light. What the moon does all day long is that it soaks up sun. It soaks up light. And when that sun goes behind the part of the planet and gives us darkness, then the moon comes to life. So what is Jesus doing here? Jesus is affirming our connection to him and our relationship to him. You see, Christian in its very name, in the original, means little Christ. When you say that you are a Christian, you are telling the world, I am a little Christ. Therefore, no one should ever take the name of Christian lightly. That's why we don't force it upon kids. So we are not paedo-baptists and baptizing our children, because no one should ever take the name of Christian lightly. Calling yourself a Christian means that you understand that you are a little Christ to those in your life, meaning that your life is like the life of the moon, soaking up sun to shine it on others. Jesus is the sun, literally, and you are the moon that shines light to others. It also means that people are in the dark. They're in the dark about themselves. They're in the dark about others. They're in the dark about the world, and they are in the dark about the points of life. And as Christians, Jesus wants us not to hide underneath our beds, but to be put on a lampstand, or to be put on a hill, to go out into the world. I think we can all agree, there is so much heaviness, there is so much sorrow, there is so much turmoil, there is so much evil, and there is so much sin in this world. Amen? Christians are supposed to go into those places of darkness, into those places of brokenness, and illuminate it. Non-Christians are in the dark about the most important reason why they are alive. And without a Christian, they are going to die in the dark. But this is the thing that I pray breaks your heart. And you pray for me that God continues to use this to break my heart. Non-Christians, too, are made in the image of God. Do you know what that means? Christians and non-Christians are eternal. You are not a body, C.S. Lewis says. You are a soul. Because you are a soul, you last forever. Christian or non-Christian, it doesn't matter if that person is an agnostic or an atheist. They are going to live forever, forever. They will spend eternity in one destination or another. And that begins to explain what predestination is about. That's a story for another time. Every single human being will live forever in one or two destinations. And a non-Christian will spend eternity without God, unless a Christian comes into their life to be salt and to be light to their darkness about Jesus. That's you, and that is me. Being a Christian means that you first and foremost are experiencing Jesus as your salt and as your light. Being a Christian means then extending Jesus' saltiness and Jesus' luminosity to others. That is missional living. And American culture does not want Christians to live like this publicly. They want us to keep, ironically, they want us to keep Jesus in the closet, or at least keep Jesus in the church. But this contradicts who God has designed us to be at our core, who Jesus is, who we are, as salt and light. Jesus died and saved you. And he wants you to make this one of your greatest priorities, just as important as a roof over your head and food on your table. And we work like mad for those two things, right? Jesus wants you to value missional living just as much as that. I'm not saying it's the greatest. Worship is. Jesus is bread of life and living water. That's the greatest goal of life. This is a high priority. But look around in America, and you'll see many Christians, maybe in this room, and many churches, I pray Heritage is not, who do not live like this. And now it's time for application, because we have to consider why this is and what to do about it. So let's get to application. And our application, we need to confront the current obstacle that is getting in our way of seeing what God is like through us. Missional living is living publicly as a Christian, letting non-Christians get into our lives and us getting into the lives of non-Christians so that they can see what Jesus is like. And this necessitates all, if you have been here for 9 years, and I'm so thankful for you, but this necessitates everything we have gone through over these last 9 years through the preaching and the teaching of the word. A commitment to knowing Jesus personally as your treasure hidden in the field. You cannot live for Jesus in front of people if he isn't the greatest treasure of your life, because people can pick up on, what's the word I should say? When you are presenting something that is not authentic. Even kids can pick up on when someone is not being genuine. People will pick up quickly that you're religious, but there's no salt. There's no light behind your living. Missional living is a privilege and a responsibility. Here's the thing. You may be the only Christian that a person will ever see in their life. Because true Christians, despite the narrative in media, has always been and will always be one of the greatest minorities. That's different than what America says to you. The white Christian European has destroyed this country. No, the Christian's always been a minority. Add on to that is that I cannot go into every single Christian that's represented here today. I can't go into your life, every single one of your lives, amongst all the people that you know, and talk to them about Jesus. I can't. You must do this. My calling as a pastor is to equip you to go and do this. By opening up your life to a non-Christian, what you're doing for them is that you're clarifying Jesus to them. They may say, I get it. You got something I don't. I don't want it, though. And we respect that. But however, by and large, American churches do not embrace missional living. Christianity in America is actually something you do. You come to church for a 60-minute experience, not at Heritage, right? We're 75 to 90. You consume, and you teach your kids to come and get, and then you move on, and you keep living life the way you always have. And you do it again and again and again. You attend church, attend a program, you hear a motivational speech that someone calls preaching, yet the life is still fundamentally the same as a non-Christian. And as a result, you know, non-Christians in America, they're highly suspicious of Christians. They're skeptical of Christians. The church in America has done a terrible job at missional living. We are bland, and we are just in the dark, as non-Christians are. The non-Christians in their lives do not see anything fundamentally different about the person that says, yeah, I go to church, and I listen to Christian music, and I have Christian friends. So why should they ever consider Jesus? Why should they ever consider Jesus' way of understanding life, understanding themselves, understanding people, understanding the world? But despite how terribly the American church has done, salt and light living is still Jesus' calling for every single Christian here in America. And verse 16 is the call. And it sounds a lot like the Great Commission. Let's take a look at it. Jesus says, therefore, let your light shine before men. Why? So that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Clearly, Christians are meant to show non-Christians what God is like, what Jesus is like. Jesus wants you to shine the light that he has given to you, to the people in your life. Yes, Christianity is personal, but based on this verse, it was never meant to be private from its inception. Never. And for anyone to demand that you keep it privately doesn't understand conscience and doesn't even understand the core of human nature. Jesus wants you to publicly live for him above yourself in front of people. Your life as a Christian is a public life, whether you realize it before or not. You're not meant to spend all of your time here in this church. So we don't fill up the church calendar where you're here most of the time. We plan on our calendar 2 times a week for probably a total of, let's just say, 4 hours to round it up. 4 hours we ask for you to be a Christian here at Heritage to devote to being on this campus by average. And the rest of the time, we want you to go out there. Go kayaking. Go on vacation. But don't consistently make it Sunday mornings and Wednesday nights. I'll be gone in a couple months on a Sunday. That's why I say, don't consistently make it. We ask for 4 hours. Because we know that you're meant to be out on the hill, on the lampstand, right? Being salty out there. Now, by glorify, when Jesus says, oh, glorify God, Jesus means to tell you that you show people what God is like. That's the incredible privilege. That's the scary responsibility. We show people what God is like. It's a blessing and a curse, I feel, sometimes. Now, by glorify, Jesus means that Christians are actually like a spotlight. They take something that's in the dark, and they bring clarity to that surrounding area. We bring clarity as to what God is like. But here's a dilemma. Every single one of us, myself included, have obstacles to living life this way, of being salty and luminous. Why do you think I've told you time after time my story of going through the checkout aisle at Publix, right? Like, I knew the fastball was coming. Kind of like Aaron Judge striking out like crazy in this World Series, right? I know the fastball is coming, and I whiffed. Cashier asks, sir, what do you do for a living? I'm a mentor for Hillsborough County Public Schools. What? Right? And why is that? We're about to take a look at a cross-reference and maybe explain why I'm like that and why you're like that. Why we will always drop the ball. We all need to be confronted with our obstacles to missional living. So Simon Peter, one of the very first Christians, failed miserably with missional living at the beginning, right? Do you remember Peter's very first on his own public activity for Jesus? It came in the night that Jesus was betrayed by Judas Iscariot. In a very public setting, in the courts of the high priest, he was asked several times, like, you sound like Jesus, you even look like Jesus, you talk like Jesus. You follow Jesus? Nope. Not even to a little servant girl could he say, I love Jesus, and I don't agree what's going on right now. He denied it every time. Why? Because self-preservation was high and deep of a value in Peter's life. Cozy self-protection was a high value. It was Peter's obstacle to being salt and light. But the resurrection changed Peter fundamentally. And I think any agnostic or anybody who's just playing religion, they need to be confronted with, how does a coward like Peter publicly go from that to never recanting Jesus again? And when Rome called him to recant and he did not, he even refused to be crucified in the manner in which Jesus was crucified. How do cowards become courageous? Because we've had many supposed Christians recant with oppression and discomfort. What was so different about Peter? And it's the resurrection. Any agnostic or atheist has to give an accounting for why that happened. Cowards don't become courageous at the face of death. They don't. So there's some sort of impetus. And Peter says, my impetus was the resurrection. So later in life, Peter wrote to a group of Christians about salt and light living. And if you're doing our reading plan, I think we read it last week. So you maybe read this recently, I hope. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 12, Peter says, to keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they're slandering you as an evildoer, they may, because of your good deeds, as they see them, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Doesn't Peter sound a lot like Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:16? Sounds a lot like Jesus. Why is that? Because Peter witnessed the Sermon on the Mount firsthand, right? Christians live publicly. And Peter makes it clear, Jesus makes it clear, our personal and public lives must be excellent. There used to be a day and age in American culture where an employer would want to hire a Christian because they knew it meant ethics, integrity, and hard work. I doubt if we polled CEOs and business owners today, if they look for somebody to be a Christian, well, they would say, oh, that may be discrimination. But they don't even think that Christians are loyal, people of integrity and dignity. But here's the reality. We'll never be perfect, but we are called to consistently live for Jesus. Non-Christians are meant to see how you live as a Christian. Living as salt and light will sometimes result with some kind of negative response from non-Christians. Like right here, Peter mentions slander, people saying things about the Christian that's not true. But this is the hope. The hope is a non-Christian is going to see a Christian's behavior, their words, their actions over time. They're going to see that, and it's going to put the spotlight on God. It's going to glorify God. That's what we mean by glorify, by seeing how the Christian lives. Now, just before this verse, Peter warns Christians about two obstacles. There's more, but Peter brings up two obstacles to salt and light living. And I think it's very important for us, as we're still in the beginning of RIPE, to think about this and consider it for us today. Look at verse 11 now. Peter says, beloved, I urge you, here's number one, as aliens and strangers, to abstain from fleshly lusts, that's two, which war against the soul. What wars against your soul, how God created you? Something about being an alien and stranger, and something about fleshly lusts. Those are the two obstacles. Let's jump in. The first obstacle to missional living is the Christian forgetting that they are an alien and that they are a stranger. You are the salt of the earth. Jesus doesn't say, you're the earth. Jesus says, you are a light to the world, not that you are the world. As a Christian, you are at home with God, and you are a stranger in this world. This world, as it currently is not your ultimate home. Filled with hurricanes and tsunamis, and trafficking of human beings, of left and right living, of marginalizing people, of bombs going off in the dead of night from one country to another. Thank God this is not our home. You are a resident alien. Christians, therefore, I believe, and if I sound like a liberal, that's okay. It's okay, because Christians should never be completely one end or the other. Christians, therefore, should always have a heart for people who are from a different place, no matter the reason why they are here. We should have some kind of heart for them. It is a fitting reminder that Christians, too, are aliens and strangers. You belong to a country that is, thank God, more deeply meaningful than living in America. But here's a dilemma about this obstacle. There is something, I mean, we're Christians in America. We are. And there is something about being an American and living in America that dulls your spiritual senses, that makes you spiritually sleepy. It can lull you into a deep sleep as to what life is about. And sleepy Christians do not value missional living. The focus is on your comfort, your ease, your cozy self-protection. And I think that's what Peter's struggle was. Now, the second obstacle to missional living is what he calls, what Peter calls, fleshly lust. And I got to clarify, because this is coming into us in English. But when you read this, you are actually not meant to take this sexually at all. It could be sexual, but not hand in glove all the time. The Greek word for fleshly lust, well, that's sarkon for lust, is epithemion. Think of epilogue, like a word after the book is done. All right, it's something that's over and above, in addition to. Epithemion, themion just means a lust. This really literally means an over desire for things. A desire that is out of order. Are we okay with that? So now we can just take the taboo nature of that word away. This word just means an over desire for things and for people. This fits into what I've often told you about my favorite Catholic saint, Saint Augustine, and his idea of misordered loves, or loving things and people out of order. Epithemion, over desire, is simply desiring anyone or anything out of God's original intended order for you to enjoy it. Sugar is good, right? It's what you do in terms of its overuse. Right? Salt is good. But there's a line where it doesn't become good. And valuing marriage or your kids or your grandkids or your hobby or money or your job, they're good things, but you can over-desire those things. Let's talk about this a little bit more. Loving things and people out of order, or Augustine would say, inordinately, it's actually counterproductive to what you actually want out of life and what your soul wants. Augustine says, God has made you for himself, and you are going to be restless until you find your rest in him. It's one of the central tenets of his autobiography called Confessions. So you think you're doing something good by loving your spouse above everything, loving your kid above everything, loving your grandchild above everything, loving your friends, even above Jesus, loving fun and kayaking and brunching and your hobbies and building things and yourself above all. I mean, isn't that a big ideal in America? Self-care, put yourself first, right? You put the mask on a plane when things are going wrong, you put on yourself first and then the other. But Christianity is not like that. Self-actualization, self-realization, self-fulfillment is a high value in America. But as Christians, we say, it's not the highest value. It's not the most important thing. Your soul was created in such a way that marriage, family, work, money, friends, hobbies, food, fun, chemicals, and substances, they are never going to bring deep, true, meaningful, lasting satisfaction to you. They can't. They were never created to, intended to. And they will break underneath the weights of that, or they will break you underneath the weights of that. So Peter tells Christians, you gotta wage war against whatever it is that you over-desire. You gotta see what you do over-desire and find ways to fight back, to put Jesus first and put that thing second or third or 22nd. Really depends on what your struggle is. So the question is, what is your current obstacle? Aliens and strangers, or over-desire? Home in this world, or desiring things more than Jesus? Are you too cozy in this world? This kingdom that you're building for yourself? Do you see yourself as an adopted son and daughter of God that Jesus died for you? And therefore you belong to a different country, a more meaningful citizenship, and a deeply more meaningful family? Is your current obstacle over desire, inordinate love for things or people? Have you replaced your soul's ultimate affection with someone or something that you cannot ultimately live without? It will break you and almost likely break the other. Either obstacle will lull you into a deep spiritual sleep. It will harden an already hard heart and keep you away from missional living. No matter how many times you say you're a Christian, and no matter how many times you walk in for a gathering of this church. So what's the solution? That's why missional living isn't the ultimate. It's a high priority as a Christian, but it's not ultimate. What is the solution? Worship is. Worship has always been and will always be the ultimate value. Loving the Lord your God with all the heart. And that means today, experiencing Jesus of Nazareth as your salt and as your light. That's what that means. It means you experience Jesus as salt and life, as living water, as bread of life, either for the very first time today, or the second time, or for many of you, the 10,000th time. And I love that about you. You experience Jesus as your flavor, as your preservative, as your light to your darkness. Because yes, you still have darkness, and so do I, and this world's darkness. Then you can rightly see yourself, or see yourself a little bit more clearly than you did before, and God, and people, and this life. And then you can be salt and light for Jesus, for people. Great commandment will always show up in the Great Commission. So now let us pray that God gives us this experience, that God would give us this desire. And let's pray that God sends us out today ready to invest in people in this way. Because you get it? Well, you're about to put our seatbelts on and we're going out to whatever it is that you do for this day. And God is sending you out amongst people to be salt and light. But you'll never be it unless you experience Jesus as salt and light.